We are opening the archives from when I first launched the show as part of a class at City College of San Francisco's KCSF. Across a decade on air, chronic crises we identified years ago only got worse in the pandemic and continue to plague our communities today as they struggle to address these familiar crises. Here's co-host and associate producer Eric Estrada with today's guest.
When we discuss gentrification in the Bay Area, it's easy to focus on the numbers, the rising costs, the changing neighborhoods, and the shifting demographics. But behind those trends are real communities, long-standing local businesses, and families who have called these places home for generations. Today, we're exploring how we can support and sustain these communities. We'll be discussing thoughtful urban planning, community partnerships, and ways to give local residents a voice in shaping their communities. Joining us are four insightful leaders actively engaged in this work. Jose Corona, Director of Equity and Strategic Partnerships from the office of former Oakland Mayor Libby Schaff. Karina Gold, co-organizer from Indian People Organizing for Change. Junius Williams, CEO of the Urban Strategies Council. And Deborah McCoy, Executive Director of the Center for Cities and Schools. Our first voice is Karina Gould. Thank you for joining us today. Let's start our conversation.
I've been working on protection of sacred sites for the last 20 years of my life. For over 20 years, we've been looking at the different places that my ancestors had actually settled here in the Bay Area prior to anyone else coming here. And what we found that was there was over 425 shell mounds or burial sites and village sites that are actually within the territory from Vallejo, and it rings entire Bay Area. I was really glad to be here today to talk about gentrification and displacement as our ancestors were the first ones to go through that. Yeah. I'm working currently on creating with a friend of mine who actually just graduated from Mills, Janella LaRose, on creating a place called Segurite Land Trust. And this land trust is the first urban Native women-led land trust in the entire country. We're hoping to look at different parcels of places in the Bay Area that we can open up to folks that are not just Native people that have come here, but people from all over in different walks of life. The reason that we found out that this is an important thing to do was in 2011, after doing all of these walks around the Bay Area to these particular sites, there was a particular site in Vallejo, California, or what's called Glen Cove, that had been, was supposed to get demolished for a park. And it had two of our shell mounds on it. And we actually had been working for over 12 years with a friend of ours, Wounded Knee de Ocampo, who had always lived there. He was a Miwok man, to save this particular site. In 2011, the city of Vallejo decided that they were going to actually file bankruptcy. And they were going to give to the city, to the park district, $40,000 worth of permitting fees for free in order to demolish this place. When we decided that there was nothing else we could do, we went to all the EIR meetings. We went to public commenting. We had people from all over the world writing letters, trying to protect this site, and nothing worked. And so we ended up actually reoccupying our territory for 109 days. And we were able to create the first cultural easement ever created in this country between a park district, a city planning place, and a federally recognized tribe. This work actually has pushed us towards creating these places and spaces all over in urban places. So that's what we think of. When we had those places in Segurite where people came from all walks of life, from all colors and ethnicities to save and protect that space, what we really found was that there was a connection of land and human beings again, that people really figured out how to take care of one another. And when we look at around today, we realize that many people, including myself, we go in our doors at night, we shut the doors and we don't talk to our neighbors. We don't know who's around us. We don't know anything except what our narrow little life is about. In creating these spaces and places that are unlike parks and unlike other open spaces or places that are called land trusts, it's about re-engaging people back into the land and really healing ourselves around those spaces and places. So that's the work that I do right now currently.
Great, thank you. Hi, I'm Deborah McCoy from UC Berkeley, the Center for Cities and Schools. Was asked to talk about pathways, right, about your work, your organization, but your own trajectory in that work. So I'll start out with kind of the connection, because I think that's really important across all the conversation and what really gets interrupted in notions of gentrification, right? The lack of connection. So the connection to your incredibly powerful work is placemaking. And I'm in the Department of City Planning, and it's this field of placemaking about how do we make places vibrant and healthy and equitable for all residents, new, old, from wherever you come and wherever you live. And I think that notion of placemaking is a very powerful opportunity that is very central within gentrification, because increasingly, I just find with technology and all this distributed notion about where communities go and you get access to opportunity everywhere, it loses that incredible importance of place, and particularly with young people that a lot of our work is focused on. So really quickly, the Center for Cities and Schools, how many folks have heard of it at UC Berkeley? Maybe a couple? Okay, great. We're an interdisciplinary action research center between the Graduate School of Education and the Department of City Planning. We're in our 12th year, which is amazing because I feel like we just started. And the whole goal is to really align public education with creating really healthy and vibrant cities. And what's kind of crazy, although in 10 years in our work, there's been a lot of change, a huge movement, and schools are no longer really the isolated institutions that they've been in the past. But higher ed and a lot of our professional schools have not really caught up with how do we really create and reconceive of the professions. Everything from school facilities, which is never really talked about within education policy, along equitable school facilities, to preparing adult city administrators, city planners, city agency leaders, and school officials to work together on integrated policy and practice called the PLUS Leadership Initiative. What I like to say is the heartbeat and my kind of passion about the center, which is the Y Plan. It's a strategy, and it stands for Youth Plan Learn Act Now. It's an educational strategy that has evolved about engaging young people critically in placemaking, in urban planning. And I love it. It's grown a great deal, starting with West Oakland and McClymonds High School, to now being in 9 cities across the nation and 5 countries, China and Japan. It's an awesome way of thinking about engaging young people in not only local action, but global connections. My own path is one of unexpected turns. I've never applied for a job in my life, and I think that's still the best way we get jobs. I know there are a handful of students in the room as well. So I think I just get inspired by work and an incredible passionate frustration for what I see that doesn't work. I think I'm committed to secondary education, or rather high school, but also K-12, because I was a high school walkout myself. I'm smart, I can handle stuff, but trauma hits all of us and kids leave, not because they're not smart, but because we have somewhere else to go that makes more sense to us, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we transform K-12 to be places of identity and places of attraction and meaning making, right? So that we all feel that it's a place for us to be safe and educated and inspired. I think there's a 30-year trajectory since my own high school experience about really trying to connect the places that we live, learn, love, and play, and our own development. And we'll talk more about specifics.
What's it?
Thank you. First of all, thank you, everybody, for having us here today. This is my second time in Mills this week.
I'm a huge fan.
You're a professor now. I'm a huge fan of Mills. I think everybody who knows me here from Mills will say that. We used to run Inner City Advisors. It was in the other room doing another panel. And I'll start by saying that I don't know if we'll get to unpacking gentrification today. Really easy issue to tackle, right? What I will say is that, candidly, that it's a really hard time for me to be in this position. I come from an organization that used to, my background, not just organization, background of really dealing with this issue personally through family, but also as an immigrant, but also now here working in the Bay Area for the past 16, 17 years. And my first experience of gentrification when I worked at Mission Economic Development Agency in the Mission District and saw the first wave of the dot-com boom to bust cycle and saw how this wave of, and I talked about it earlier this week, of wave of people that had a great idea, no business plan, displacing people that had amazing businesses and very profitable businesses that had been doing it for 10, 20 years were being displaced by these ideas. And that was when I really cut my teeth in understanding how just wrong the system was. And when you talk about capital, these folks that were getting capital by just an idea and a page and what they looked like, whereas other people that looked like Junius and me and Karina that were not getting the same opportunities were getting displaced because they couldn't access capital, which is critical to them staying in the neighborhoods. How do they access capital to increase wealth, whether it's small business ownership or home ownership? So I saw this first wave firsthand in the Mission District, really dedicated my passion to really identifying ways to address it first from the ground up and running Inner City Advisors to really working with the business community to help these businesses become not only profitable enterprises, but also ones that are responsible and hire people in the community to hire locally, but also provide good wages and good quality jobs. And now in this position, I say it's hard because the rate in which people are getting displaced in the city of Oakland is much faster than what I experienced when I was in the Mission District, which is really scary for me. So what are we doing? And we're not doing it fast enough. I'll say that. I'm not sure we'll come to a solution in a few years, but one of the reasons why I took this job was because there was an opportunity for me. I was one of those that said, I'm never going to work in government. I had an adverse reaction and everyone said, you're going to go to government, run for office. I'm like, no, this is just not me. That's not who I was. And it kind of still is not. I'm a very untraditional guy in City Hall right now. But why I took this job was because I saw the opportunity. The only way we were going to really change or at least make a dent or slow down this way was if we really addressed policy issues and systems change and really became and really affected that. And when I saw this position, I went for it for many reasons, but primarily because I really thought that there was a voice needed in City Hall with this perspective that said, if you're really serious about equity, if you're really serious about changing the way the direction the city of Oakland is going right now, you have to engage everybody. You have to create partnerships, but you have to be, it has to be part of your mission. I got the job. And now I'm here. And the main reason, and I'll talk more about it later, but I am really the focus on using the business community as a vehicle to help invest in addressing the very issues that are getting displayed. So I'll stop there for now, but you know, and I'll come back more to the business strategic partnerships piece. But I will say that there's a lot of disparities that we're trying to address. And when we talk about Oakland, Oakland is prospering, but not everybody's benefiting.
Thank you, Jose. Deuce, July
2. Good morning, Junius Williams. I'm CEO of Urban Strategies Council. I'm also here representing the Oakland Community Land Trust, which I'm a co-founder of and currently serve as the chair of the board of directors. Just really briefly about Urban Strategies Council. We're a social impact organization. We use tools of research, policy, innovation, collaboration, and advocacy to achieve equity and social justice. The primary strategies that we employ in our work is trying to use research and data to direct decision making and action, to build cross-sectoral collaborative leadership to move major social change agendas within the community, and doing policy and systems reform to try to structurally alter the way that government, business, and others behave. We focus on public education, on what we call economic opportunity, which is a combination of economic development, affordable housing, workforce development, and income and asset development, and then community health and safety, especially issues related to our fetish with mass incarceration in this country and the resulting problems that it produces in terms of reentry to neighborhoods that are already highly distressed because of our failure historically to invest in them. We do all of that work through a lens of equity and social justice. Race is the defining design element of America, and there is no issue that you can adequately address if you don't have a race lens on it. As Gunnar Myrdal said, must be 60 years ago, our dissonance with race and our inability to talk about and deal with race is stunning in the sense that it was such a defining characteristic in the evolution of America. And we're not going to solve social problems in this country until we get comfortable with dealing with what equity is really about, which is treating people differentially and with some advantage if you have historically denied them access to opportunities. That is especially the case with Black folks as it relates to having stripped us of the value of our labor to build America, with Native folks having stripped them of the very land, and similar with Latino, especially Mexican-American populations, who also got stripped of their land with no value. I also want to make a couple of quick comments. We don't use, except in response to other people, the term gentrification. It is ambiguous and loaded. Some people might consider me as a person who is works in a nonprofit, but was able to buy a house as a gentrifier. It's too loaded. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't even like to try to unpack it. I do, though, know that there's a problem of displacement, that long-term residents here can no longer afford to live here. And therefore, it represents a significant problem. Some of them people who are coming in are Black, they're brown, they're Asian. Many of them might be the first generation of real economic prosperity for their families. And as a result of a lot of blood, sweat, and tears of their families, that they're in those positions. And I have trouble casting them as somehow gentrifiers. I mean, these are people just like me. I'm one generation removed from a custodian and a nursing aide. It's not like I'm the vaulted gentry intergenerationally. And to put that label on me and similar people, I think, confuses it. I would say one other point with respect to my approach. I appreciate what Jose is saying in terms of his work with the business community. My focus is on government. The largest pool of resources available in terms of capital for about anything that we need to do is government money, over which we can exercise control. I got no control over the Ubers of the world, who in part have a business model for violating the law. When the young brother on the street adopts a business model of breaking the law, his ass goes to jail. White boys at Uber ain't going to jail, and they have a very deliberate model of going into communities all over the world and ignoring the transportation regulation in there and forcing governments to its knees with the market. While I appreciate that they're here, and just like Jose is saying, I'm trying to work with them too, because when you got an 800-pound gorilla in your cage with you, you try to make peace on some level. But I still resent the fact that the underlying principle, and John and some other folks are in another one, if Black people or Black males did that the Uber executives done, we would have them under jails right now. And we're exalting it as one of the profound and most revolutionary business models known yet in the 21st century. And I focus on government. I know all of my money's in government, and they got an obligation, and I've got a system. Little bit archaic, but I can at least vote them out. I can't vote the board of directors or the owners of an Uber or a GM or any of them out. So I can't control them, but I can control what happens with government resources. And we have wealth that we are spending foolishly on things like incarceration and on other things, as opposed to how we use that to invest capital in communities and businesses that would better serve our people.
You've gotten an overview of the panel and their work. I wanted to just turn to the audience and then to the panel. And if you would kind of flesh out a little bit of the forces and elements you've heard from it today with regards to housing, education, policy, funds. So with your help, what I'd like to do is just put up on the board some of the elements and or forces that are underlying displacement, underlying gentrification, however you want to couch those terms. So with that, I'm going to turn to the panel and ask them to take it. You guys have obviously heard. What else from your perspective have we captured that you're working on that you'd like to add to?
Well, I'd like to just offer a couple of observations regarding the economic context of this, that some work that we did a year ago for the city's housing equity roadmap, one of the most telling findings of the research team was the level of housing burden in the city. We did a geographic analysis of mean income by census tract all over the city, mean purchase price of the housing, mean rental price of units. There is no census tract in the whole city of Oakland where people are not housing burdened. And housing burden by HUD definition is that you're spending 30% of your income for housing costs. In fact, over half of the people in this city are what are considered to be severely housing burdened, which means they're spending more than half of their income. What we surmise is happening, and I saw it with my own son who moved back here, is I can afford really with a little strain to, if I'm a high earner in that highest echelon, I could really afford, if I wanted to, the housing cost there. What it comes at is the expense of my disposable income. You go down to the uptown area and I want to go to them clubs and them nice five-star restaurants. So people are making a decision that I'm going to go down to the next rung of the housing ladder to pay a little less. That pushes people at that level down. You do that all the way down to the bottom of the rung, and a bunch of black and brown folk in flatlands ain't got nobody to push out. So they're dispersed to Antioch and Pittsburgh and Vallejo and all of those. But it's a systemic problem on almost every income level in the city that it's occurring. You juxtapose that with the economics of income. A sustainable wage income, and I'm going to circulate another document, and you can go and see the report that CFED, Citibank, and Urban Strategies released about a month ago. A sustainable wage income for a family of four in Oakland is about $80,000 a year. And if you consider the number of low-income families who have only have one wage earner, they're in a bunch of $80,000 a year jobs out there, but that's a circumstance. The point that I want to make is that we've got to be realistic about what the sustainable wage is and throw out minimum wage discussion. Minimum wage is $12.50. Sustainable wage is someplace between $17.70 an hour and $18 an hour, assuming two people working full time. In order for the typical person as a single person to be able to do that, you're going to need kind of 3.8 jobs or something, given the average wage. My point is that we've got a structural defect here. We're telling poor people and others, get in job training programs and skill up to get income. Well, there ain't a bunch of $80,000 a year jobs out there. Much of the growth in the economy in the Bay Area is in the service, hospitality, and other industries, none of which, you know, there are those coding jobs that are 80,000, 100,000, those tech jobs, but most of the growth and most of what is going to be accessible to the low income people that we're talking about are entry level, and we're talking 15, 17. We got a structural problem. It is impossible for many people to earn enough money, low income people, to be able to stay in Oakland. But we keep saying to them, go get your training, act together. And if you work hard and all this stuff, it's going to be okay. It ain't. There are not a commensurate number of jobs for people that would permit them to have a sustainable wage. So there are a couple of structural economic problems that we're dealing with here that we got to be realistic about. In fact, I know people don't like to say it or hear it, but in some respects and in some neighborhoods in the city, we have lost the displacement battle. We have essentially lost it. And the issue now becomes, what do we do with the people that we failed and are being displaced? And it calls into question issues like policy. One of the things that we're working on right now is that we've got a community benefits agreement on Brooklyn Basin. The city has one with the Army base that are based on residency. If you are a resident, then the contractors have to hire 50% Oakland residents. Well, what do we do with the fact that all them people are now living in Pittsburgh and Antioch and all of those places who can't establish residency? So my only point is that as much as I want to keep fighting for the issues of whether or not we can stem the tide of displacement, we also need to be dealing with the reality that it's happened, that there are floods of people. And what does it mean in terms of policy for the city? The fact that we've got probably the Oakland annex out in, what is it, that corridor in Antioch there that so many Oakland families now live in. What are we going to do around the fact that we failed them and now they don't qualify for those good jobs that the city is extracting from the developer on the Army base that are career construction jobs? They ain't eligible for them right now.
How do you roll that down? How do you establish effective rightly control in Oakland?
Well, there are a group of base building groups who just declared that they're going to do a ballot measure campaign to attack the deficiencies in rent control, rent stabilization system in the city of Oakland. I can send to somebody. They just sent me the ballot language that they're going to start the campaign around. But it's a really important point. We don't have rent control in Oakland. And you got a very defective rent stabilization board and system. And all of that needs to be beefed up because it favors landlords right now. Landlords can raise rents in Oakland, and the onus is on the tenant to initiate action to try to change it. When in many jurisdictions, it's the opposite. The landlord must go affirmatively to get permission to change it. And you know what that means. Just the dynamic of that difference could make a difference for a lot of families.
All right, I'm going to turn to Jose. We've been talking about government policy. Before we go there, just if you would send me that information or just send it to Carissa, and then we could put it up on the website so people can get educated. Okay. So from a government's perspective, and you're a government guy here, sorry about that.
Got it, I'll take it.
But obviously it goes back to what Julius touched on, the fact that government has the biggest pool of funds. Everyone in the room hopefully is registered and votes, and you can vote with your dollars, et cetera. From your perspective, what do you think are some of the things that the city can do policy-wise to help perhaps set in motion policy and coding, because another big part of this, is, of course, is coding. And then we get back to our home ownership part. And then, of course, we get into the housing component as well.
I'll try to take a crack at it. I think one of the things that Junius mentioned, it, the city just released a report on its housing issues. It was taken by Urban Strategies Council, did also with Policy Link around the housing equity roadmap, which really calls to protect, first and foremost, that the residents are already here. So there was an AmeriCorps saying, over the next 8 years, protect 17,000. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but protect 17,000 people from being displaced, or units from being displaced from the same issues that you described in the background. How do we do that? And there are certain tactics around that, around forcing or making stronger those rent control. And how do we enforce it? Right now, you're right. I'll be the first one to admit it. It's not enforced with the same rigor that it should be. So it's getting to that. I think the other thing is the issue that we talked about, that the city of Oakland saw a huge increase in population over the past 10 years, but very little housing was built. And that's not just an Oakland issue, it's a regional issue. So part of the plan is also creating 17,000 new units of housing over the next 8 years. And right now, again, for those of you, you might already know, it's no secret that Oakland doesn't have an inclusionary zoning policy. So now it's starting to, it's just about to, I think, propose to city council an impact fee, which goes an impact fee charged to developers to build affordable housing. And that's just the first start. It's not the end all be all. So there's stuff on the housing issue, which is the big issue on, and then there's affordability issue, but there's also the ability to afford. So you have to be talking about jobs as well. Mm-hmm. So they go hand in hand. You can't just say, it's just a housing issue. You will keep losing the battle. So how do we ensure that not only the adults that are living in Oakland, but also the young people, are also getting prepared for these jobs of the future? You know, Junius is right. There's not a lot of $80,000 jobs, but we met with PG&E, we met with AC Transit, we met with BART. There's a lot of $80,000 jobs there that nobody knows about because they're not sexy. They're not the coding jobs that everybody wants to put engineers and coders and build the next Mark Zuckerberg. And those jobs, between 40 and 50% of them, across those BART, AC Transit, PG&E, are eligible for retirement. You're going to see thousands of jobs over the next few years of people who retire from those institutions. And these are skilled technicians. These are electricians. These are people that, if you have that skill, you're going to have a job, whether it's a PG&E, AC Transit, or BART. If you're an electrician, there's another company called Helix Electric, one of the biggest electrical companies, contractors in the country. Here in Oakland, nobody knows about him. So you go to these inner city neighborhoods, you talk to these kids, and they want to be a coder. But do you have the talent to be a coder? And by the way, do you know that in technology, only 25% of the coding jobs are actually taking technology? So what about finance? What about operations? What about HR? What about those jobs? Are we doing enough as a community to prepare those kids for those jobs? Because 65% of the jobs in tech are not tech engineering jobs. So we should be opening up the pool and thinking about how do we position that and how do we shape our workforce system, which is another thing that is under me, is how do we shape this workforce system so we're not placing people in shitty jobs. These organizations that have done that for 15, 20 years of just placing people and they get money from government. These organizations that have been doing the same tactics for the same for 20 years, and have our people advanced? Have our people gotten better jobs? No. So we need to look at it differently. We need to really create these workforce development programs, which we are creating. We have what's an opportune time right now, WIOA, to actually restructure our workforce investment board in Oakland to be more connected to actually creating jobs of the future and supporting these workforce development programs that are going to prepare our kids for the future. And then on the education, it's a huge economic development strategy. But the mayor just launched the Oakland Promise, cradle to career initiative that starts at birth to ensure that we set the expectation that every kid in Oakland is going to graduate from college. Because right now, only 10%, so 10 out of 100 kids and ninth graders in Oakland graduate from college. Only 10. That's unacceptable. If you hear the mayor talk about it, I mean, even though it pisses me off, all she talks about is the Oakland Promise, but it's a great initiative. It's a great start looking at the future. But then you also have to be working on the conditions, because as Junie said, this Oakland kid might be a kid in Oakland schools today, but next week he might get displaced or she might get displaced and they might be in Antioch anymore. So all this Oakland Promise might be for naught if we're not talking about securing the conditions, the housing, the jobs, and even the public safety, to making sure that our streets are safe, to make sure that our kids are able to walk to school safely. Around housing policy, there's workforce development policy. I can't say enough around the business community that we have to be engaging them. We can't just vilify the tech industry. And many of my friends are in tech. And these are people that are born and raised in Oakland. So we can't just be so generalist about vilifying one industry. We have to go deeper into that. And we have to be engaging the community. And yes, Uber's a bunch of douchebags. I get it. I get it. But that douchebag has money. And I'm not afraid to rob Peter to pay Paul. I'm not. For me, that's okay. If they're able to invest in the very things that everybody in this room cares about,
be accountable,
and hold them accountable to that, then I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, call me whatever you want, but I'm okay with that.
To that point, Jose, are there programs or policies you are in the midst of putting together to engage our private sector?
Well,
and then
yeah.
I would add to that the private sector, and then there's a comment about the nonprofit sector. So is there a thought within the city's purview of trying to integrate the private sector, public sector together within, I'm going to turn to Deborah, talk a little bit about education, Karina, as well, because they're all completely interwoven.
Yes. So I think someone mentioned the 12th Street parcel. Yes, city was wrong in how it approached it. And I think part of the problem there was that the city of Oakland didn't have a policy around how it uses its publicly owned land. And now part of this housing cabinet that came out is actually creating a policy of how it uses its publicly owned land, its city owns, for public benefit. Before, there was no policy. It was on a case-by-case basis. So it could be negotiated by Junius as a developer came to me and said, I have this great thing to build. And before, Oakland suffered from just being able to like, oh, just give us anything. Mm-hmm. Bring capital. Now, you can say, no, it's not about luxury development. This is publicly owned land that has to have public benefit to it. So there's that, a publicly owned land. Someone also mentioned participatory. So we just allocated, or we worked with through city council and through Michelle Bird from Housing and Community Development to allocate some of the CDBG funding by a participatory budgeting process. That's $2.5 million out of millions of CDBG money, but that's a start. So we want to encourage more participatory budgeting in the way we allocate public funds.
You are listening to Voices of the Community. We're at the halfway point of our archive highlight episode. Our panel today is helping us unpack gentrification in Oakland and the Bay Area and how it affects our communities. We rely on your support to produce these stories. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation at voicesofthecommunity.com. While you're there, you can dive deeper into this episode and explore our other series. Now let's get back to the discussion.
Both Deborah and Kuni both been engaged in education, and we heard from some of our participants today that the education program K through 12 is somewhat broken. Can you share with us a little bit about either policy you're creating, models that you've seen work, recommendations?
I think I'd quickly just say, not just a K-12 lens, but a K-16 lens, particularly being at Mills, and I think the higher ed is a huge part of the trajectory you need to think about. One is, it's so important, the focus on housing, and the federal government has completely stepped away from really a lot of its housing investment around equity role. It's obviously a huge part of it. But there's a real big focus of housing policy is school policy. And we tend to think of them in silos, but where you live, where you get access to live in 75% of the districts across the country drive where you go to school. So that's just a housing policy, a school policy is a really important frame for how we think about connecting the sectors and connecting this work. And it's often kept in silos. It's, again, it's shifting across the country, but it's a really important lens.
And that's significant in Oakland because of the choice model and charters.
So it's more in Oakland than other places. So there are four key points that I would make on this line of schools. One is attendance policy, which is driven often by where you live in housing. Oakland has largely been a neighborhood-based housing model. So where you live, particularly in the elementary school and the middle school, is based on where you have an address. In Berkeley, it's one of the oldest desegregation policies and is decoupled. And in San Francisco, they've changed it a lot, but you have a much more of a equity focus on where you go to school and where you live. I know in Oakland right now, there's a lot of shifting on how to do that. There's a big framing of the superintendent around equity. It is a very difficult issue around the school attendance policy and choice. Choice policy to many education reformers, it's going to be the great night, the great silver bullet, but it's often choices for whom. So who gets to make those choices is very much driven by who owns housing and who has access to that information. So one is attendance policy, and we can talk more specifically about that. Second is absolutely teacher housing. So we're actually working with Oakland Unified right now a bit on really thinking about teacher housing. If you can't retain and attract high quality teachers, forget whatever education models we've got going out there. Teachers are so core how to provide a high quality education system that prepares us for both jobs and democracy, right? That they're both equally important from our perspective. So teacher housing is enormously important. Oakland is trying to do some interesting stuff. It is controversial. I will say that right now. It's been in the papers. It's so intuitive. Yes, you want to give good teacher housing. It's a great idea, whether it's through mortgage or rental assistance or building a new development. I will say from a teaching perspective, teachers are like, just pay us more so we don't need to be subsidized for housing. Why? You would never subsidize lawyers. Why are you subsidizing teachers? So we are trying to help inform the issue, but it's complex, right? But teacher housing is critical. The retention of quality teachers, what are the drivers pushing our teachers, particularly teachers of color? So the majority of our education teaching force is white, right? And with that comes the white privilege that comes into our teaching no matter what and how enlightened many of us white teachers want to be. There is a real priority that needs to happen about educating, attracting, and retaining teachers of color in our communities. And that has, again, to do with housing as well as how much we pay those teachers. So that's third. The fourth, which is really amazing, and it's not spoken about enough, but universities are huge real estate agents and brokers. Berkeley owns so much property, right? In Oakland, in Richmond. There's this huge new issue around, and I'm going to get in trouble if anyone's from UC Berkeley here, but you know, this global campus, which is great about the new global education, but it's largely driven by real estate ownership of what the land Berkeley owns in Richmond and waterfront property. And there are huge issues around gentrification. Again, higher ed, not just as a form of preparing our future workforce, but as real estate brokers, particularly when UC is largely bankrupt. I mean, we don't have public investment now. Less than 9% of our budget comes from the state. It's not really a public institution. So what do they have? They have real estate, as do many public school districts. So it's another important player in how we think about this work. That's it. Awesome. And I can get to some policies, but that's good enough.
Great. I think that one of the things I wanted to say is that all these brilliant ideas up here about what's going wrong. I think one of the major groups of folks that we have left out in our conversation are children and women that are pregnant and women that are on aid. And how do they fit into this category of gentrification and being pushed out? And how is it that the needs are being met of these children and of these women that need the access to programming so that they can get the jobs that are $80,000 at BART and PG&E and AC Transit, that those things are a disconnect, you know, and I work in K-12 education through the American Indian Child Resource Center. Yeah. I'm the Title VII coordinator for Office of Indian Ed for the last 10 years in Oakland Unified School District. Oakland Unified School District has bounced us back and forth to a different person that's a liaison between our agency and Oakland Unified School District for the 10 years that I've been there in that same job. And it's been really difficult. Our children that are American Indian in Oakland Unified School District are
about 300 students. So we're often invisibilized. And so when we talk about education, we have to talk about these populations that are invisibilized on purpose, that they don't disaggregate the information on American Indian students, on Pacific Islander students, on students that are LGBT. And we have to talk about higher education. When we get our kids there, how do we keep them there? Mm-hmm. When you're looking at students that are having to pay exorbitant amounts of money to be educated in the United States, when many of the students that goes to Mills and goes to UC Berkeley are homeless and can't afford to feed themselves, when they're trying to figure out how to do this as first generation students going into these large places of education. So these are people that are on the outskirts that nobody's talking about, that has to do with those folks that are putting money back into our communities, right? And so for me, it's like, how do we begin those conversations? Because we're talking about, I'm working with a program right now of particular people that are looking at, there's this process in Oakland Unified School District about the African-American achievement, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking at male achievement, right? And then there's a group of folks that are saying, well, what about the young girl? They are getting, young women of color are getting disproportionately suspended, expelled out of Oakland Unified School District, sexually harassed, and nobody is talking about these particular things. So we're always talking about it through a male lens, even a male color of lens. So we're not talking about these issues that are important. So for me, it's like, how do we begin to have those conversations as well? How do we begin to talk about education when we want our kids to go to school, right? I want my kids to go to school, right? I want my grandchildren to go to school. But at this moment, I have a niece that's living with two children in my upstairs bedrooms right now, and she cannot afford any place. I have a daughter with a grandson that's living in a room someplace else because that's where they choose to live. I have another daughter that has two children that live in Oakland, but are going to be displaced really soon because they can't afford to live here. So we're being moved out of our traditional homelands as well. So there's another layer of the colonization that continues to happen because we're also invisibilized. So there's all of these invisible pockets of people that are here, or we're working with in Oakland because we are so huge, right? Oakland comes and there's, I think, 47 different languages that are spoken in Oakland alone. I think when I'm getting a little off track, but one of the things I wanted to also talk about is that how you can choose in Oakland to go to school, right? I know that as a mom that put their kids through Oakland Unified School District, that I filled out that paperwork in December and found out every March that my kids were going to their local schools. Today's the day we'll find out. Every single year that I put it, they went to their local schools. So I don't think that actually works. Mm-hmm. I think that we have a beautiful population of community-based schools that are charters here, that we have choices in that kind of way. And there's also a long waiting list to get into there. So only certain kids get into those ones as well. So we're looking at populations of kids that are being displaced. I'm on the board of the Oakland Street Academy, and I'm a graduate from there. Been there for a lot of years, and I think that school works with our student populations. I actually funnel a lot of the American Indian students there because they can actually finish. Most of our kids don't graduate because they never get to high school. Most of our students actually, they drop out in eighth grade, and then there's no way to track them. Oakland Unified is like they're disappeared. But they're actually still here within our city limits. So our students, when we get them to actually graduate, which is probably around 10 or 11 kids a year, is pretty big, right? 10 or 11 American Indian students that graduate a year. And then of those, we probably get three or four into college. And even our best students that we're able to work with to get them to college, to get them to all of these great places, they're so fearful that they can't survive. So maybe one of them will make it. So it's really discouraging that we are working in systems that don't work for us. Mm-hmm. For me, it's about taking apart this system that doesn't work and to recreate it. We're always trying to spin our wheels as human beings about how do we fit into this system that was never created for us? This system that we need to figure out how to redo this, right? How do we do this in a different kind of way? In middle school, I actually homeschooled my daughters because it was just horrendous the way the school district was being at that time. And it actually worked. They actually did well. They excelled in high school. They actually were able to get into colleges in the San Francisco State and San Jose State. But it's problematic that
I'm working full time and I have to do that, right? So how do moms, single moms, deal with these kinds of things? Those are the things that I think that we need to talk about. Those are the real people that are here. Those are the women that aren't able to work those 3.8 jobs in order to stay here in Oakland and should have the opportunity to do that. I think rent control is way beyond time to talk about it. We're talking about rent control now when people are being charged. Somebody said $1,000 for a room. Right? So rent control of what? What are we controlling, right? We're controlling that the landlord's able to hold you down to $2,300 for a two bedroom apartment and you get to stay there, if not more.
One of the things that I know that you've been a big champion of in your programs include is wraparound services. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could share with the audience a little bit more about why the wraparound services and what are the services that your team provides, mm-hmm. and then how does that enable people to get out of what you described?
So the education program that we work with, we're an Indian Education Center, one of 21 in the state of California. And we get state funding. We also get OFCY funding to do that. And then I get Title VII funding for my job through the federal government by counting Indian kids, basically. And what happens is that we are able to provide services for these kids at our center, which is in a great location across from the lake outside of all the gang areas. We pick them up from 8 different schools. We take them to our location 4 days a week. We feed them. We give them an hour of tutoring services, an hour of cultural arts so that they're engaged in themselves. They feel good. They're resilient. They remember who they are as human beings. And then they have outside activities as well. But on site, we also have case managers. We also have people that are provide therapy for them. We have folks that will go to, because we are started out as a foster care agency. Many of our students have been in and out of different kinds of foster care or crisis places. So we're able to provide those kind of services as well. We're able to take our students on field trips to higher education places from the time they're in sixth grade on up to try to get them engaged in those kind of things. So I think that those kind of services are good. We're also teaching financial literacy. We have a program where they get internships to do traditional cooking and learn how to prepare those kinds of things. So it's a life skill about how do you take care of yourself when you leave home. And so those are the kind of things that I think that's really important for young people to know. We also engage them in cultural things like not just arts and crafts like things, but actually talking about what does it mean to live in an urban area and be American Indian, right? And how does that look? Because most of our students don't look like me. They look like all of you. Our children are third generation in Oakland because they had been moved from the 50s and 60s. And so families have been mixed with every other nationality. And so many of our children are mixed with African American or Mexican, or we even have kids that are Yemen and American Indian. And so how does that look to also talk about Black Lives Matters with those kids? How does that look like to talk about Alex Nieto? How does that look like to talk about all of these injustices that they see and have a safe place to do that? So those are some of the kind of things that we're able to do at the center and hopefully bring our children up in those kinds of ways.
I'm going to turn back to Julius for a moment because I want to go back to, obviously, we've identified housing as one of those big issues. And Julius, could you kind of walk the audience through your land trust model, but some of the policies you've been working on trying to stabilize?
So let me say, contextually, there is an emerging school of thought with respect to something called community wealth ownership that we've been dabbling in, and it's represented in a number of different ways. Worker-owned cooperative businesses are one manifestation of that. Land trust and other shared equity ownership models on sort of the right end of it are even things like community benefit corporations that for the past couple of years have been authorized to operate. We started at the height of the foreclosure crisis, a land trust. The basic model for a land trust is that the land trust retains ownership of the underlying real estate. So we buy a parcel with a house on it. We sell the house or the improvements technically to the family, and we retain ownership of the underlying real estate, and we give the family or the owner revolving 99-year lease so that they've got it. And for example, in our houses in Oakland, we've got about 18 houses now in Oakland. Our lease fees are about $50 to $75 a month for the underlying real estate. It's simply enough for us to be able to take care of our management functions. As you can imagine, just thinking about housing costs, about 25 to 35% of the cost when you buy a house is underlying real estate in a market, a strong market like Oakland. So we are able to sell our houses well. And then there's also public subsidy. So if you think about East Oakland right now, houses are running $400,000 to $500,000 in East Oakland. We're selling our houses to families for $125,000 to $165,000. We've taken all of the public subsidy that the city and the government typically invest, and we put it in those houses. The difference between the typical model that the city does is it's permanently affordable. So our families agree. We sell to families who earn 50 to 80% of area median income, and they agree as a stipulation for buying a house from us that if they want to sell that house, they will sell it to another family making 50 to 80% of AMI so that nobody ever walks away with the public subsidy. Once there's a public subsidy, it's going to be there. And secondly, our houses remain affordable in perpetuity. We have a community governance structure, the typical land trust model. The board of directors is one-third homeowners or tenants in the land trust. About a third of the folks are other technical expertise, and about a third of the folks are people who live in the neighborhoods where we own houses. We had a city grant initially through the, it's been so long, I can't even remember it, neighborhood stabilization program that permitted us to purchase the original set of houses. We are moving from the single family housing model to a scattered site, small multifamily strategy. And this is really important. What's happening in the affordable housing world here is the big players like Unity Council, like East Bay Asian Local Development Corporation. It's not economically feasible for them to play in the small unit market. So there's a gap right now that people are being pushed out of duplexes to 20 unit houses. That's where most of the mischief is going on right now around displacement. So what we're trying to do is to move into that market and purchase those by organizing the tenants when they become aware that somebody's getting ready to sell, to go in and purchase it. And the way that we keep it affordable is resident management. So what we are going to do is we'll purchase the property, we'll cross-subsidize the property, we'll be able to go down to about 30% of AMI, but we'll balance that by bringing in some tenants who are going to pay 80% of AMI so that the building subsidizes itself. And we keep costs down by forming a nonprofit corporation among the tenants, and they are going to take responsibility for keeping costs low by some of the building maintenance and management that they will do. So that's basically the land trust model. We're part of, there's also Northern California Land Trust in Berkeley that owns here, San Francisco Land Trust, Sonoma. There are about five of us in the Bay Area, all using this model. And it's very important because it changes the structure of ownership. Our families are coming in and have home ownership as an option when otherwise in this market, in East Oakland, they can't afford a $400,000 home. Very quickly, the other thing that I think is really important in this new wave of ownership mechanisms are the worker-owned cooperatives. And I think either Allison or Hillary from Project Equity are here. Very important for a couple of reasons very quickly. Worker-owned cooperatives, if people aren't going to be, the largest way in which you can build wealth in America is home ownership. If we cut people off from that, there ain't another mechanism, except though that worker-owned cooperatives may provide a way for people to build wealth, not through their housing, but through their ownership of the places in which they work. So it's a really big thing. But two other things. If you are undocumented, well, you can't work for me legally. You can own a business legally. So for undocumented folks, and I shouldn't say it so much because the right will figure it out and close the loophole, but it's a loophole. So if you organize workers, what the folks that just changed their name, they're now Prospera.
Prospera used to be Wages.
Used to be Wages and is now Prospera as a worker owned cooperative business.
Because as an individual, yeah. You can work with a tax ID number.
Right.
And you can own a business as a tax ID. So
right.
Collective becomes you're all yeah. owners of that business.
The other place is for people who are formerly incarcerated and have a felony conviction and nobody will hire them. Well, if you have your own business, like the cooperatives in Cleveland, where they're in the neighborhood, the washer, and 90% of the people there are formerly incarcerated or former substance abusers. If you own the business, you make the decision about what the standards for hiring are. So I would encourage people to Project Equity is a leader nationally in thinking around this and how we scale it up. Arizmendi Bakery, y'all know Arizmendi, is another model of that. So it's really important. And one final note quickly. Somebody said voting with your feet. Capitalism runs amok because even when we have options to behave differently, we don't because we spend unconsciously. Part of what we need to do is reacculturate ourselves to where our money is go. And if we're in the Bay Area and we've got options like Arizmendi and others, we damn sure should go there and spend our money there. We're making them more vulnerable than they need to because we just go to a bakery to get a damn donut. Well, it's a political action to go to Arizmendi or to go to one of the cooperative businesses so that they don't struggle. And that's how we have another option for building wealth in this country besides just owning homes. So I'm going to stop.
Thank you, Jenny. We have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to have
run for office.
Come in and then go back.
I just want to say just how do we keep people accountable, basically? And I think that it's been really difficult for me working around not the education piece of it, but about developments that happen in cities. I've gone to tons of EIR meetings and environmental impact reports. But unless you know that it's happening and unless you're invested in that, you don't know that it's going on, right? And so how do you get that information? For me, it's like people tell me these things are happening. I ended up at a zoning meeting last night and because of this big development that somebody wants to put it down on 4th Street. And it's one of our sacred places. And the interesting thing was that we were actually able to do some movement and maybe not having this development happen. Maybe trying to figure out a different way of doing it, not just because it was a sacred site, but because Union Pacific has a buy into it, that this is a crazy place to do it. There's traffic jam stuff. There's all of these kinds of things. So not just going to city council, but there's all these other committees that we don't talk about. Just like somebody was saying that those sexy jobs, those not sexy jobs, like an HR and stuff like that, those are where decisions are being made a lot. And that we don't know. We know that we can go to City Hall and we could be like, like that. But there are these little pockets of people that are making decisions outside of that particular meeting. And I think that we need to be aware and informed about who those people are and how do they make those decisions and let them see us. And that's the problem is that it's always on us to make sure that we're there. It's not about them coming out to us. So it's difficult about trying to figure out. It is about changing how the system works. It's a different a way of getting communication out from the city to regular folks so that we know what's happening in our communities, not all of a sudden reacting to it, but being a part of it.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
That wraps up this archive highlight episode of Voices of the Community. We want to extend a massive thank you to our incredible panel, Jose Corona, Karina Gold, Junius Williams, and Deborah McCoy, for sharing their deep expertise and their passion for the people of Oakland and the Bay Area. Today's conversation made it clear that while the forces of gentrification and displacement are deeply entrenched, the solutions are already growing from the ground up. Whether it's through community land trusts, workers-owned cooperatives, demanding equitable education, or holding the private sector accountable, the power to build and retain community wealth belongs in our hands. We produce this archive highlight series to give you context, to show that crises we face today aren't new, and neither are the solutions. If you want to go deeper, visit voicesofthecommunity.com and click on the archive series where you'll find full bios for every guest, links to every original episode, and resources from organizations doing this work on the ground. If today's conversation resonated with you and you're looking to dive a bit deeper, we'd love to share a few related episodes from our COVID-19 series. For those interested in land trusts and cooperative ownership, we highly recommend our conversations with the Northern California Land Trust and East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. If you want to learn more about the housing burden and displacement, check out our spotlight episodes featuring the Coalition on Homelessness, Compass Family Services, and our Making the Invisible Visible series. We also explore access to capital and economic equity through our work with the Mission Asset Fund and the Resources for Community Development. And finally, if you're looking for stories about youth empowerment and education, you can hear how organizations like Tech Exchange and Youth Spirit Artworks are preparing the next generation. And if this show gave you something, put a value on it. Your donation directly funds the next series. Go to voicesofthecommunity.com and click on the donate button to support our work. Now back to George Koster to wrap up our episode.
These shows are only possible because of our dedicated team, associate producer Eric Estrada for his co-hosting and technical wizardry, and designer Casey Nance of Citron Studios for making the show look exceptional. A special thanks to Dr. Cecil Hale for supporting Voices of the Community at KCSF, and to broadcast partners KSFP, LPFM 102.5 FM in San Francisco, and KPCA LPFM 103.3 FM in Petaluma, and of course, to KCSF that you can stream on TuneIn for amplifying these voices. I'm George Koster in San Francisco, and join us for our next episode as we continue lifting the voices that shape and strengthen our communities. Thank you for listening, supporting, and sharing. Until then, remember, your voice matters.